When Alan Locos, founder of the Community Meditation Center in New York City, found himself trapped in the burning wreckage of a plane crash in Myanmar on Christmas Day 2012, it was his basic human instinct to do everything in his power to get himself and his wife out of the plane and survive. He writes about the experience in the new book, Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. It is a great pleasure to welcome Alan Locos to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. Happy to be here.
Once you get through the shock of what happened to you and realizing and putting it into perspective, at what point do you learn a lesson that you believe you can share with others?
Well, the experience itself of being in the plane, of course, was sudden, unexpected, dramatic, terrifying. But at the same time, I, right there, standing in fire, while obviously scared, I was present to what was going on. I knew what was going on. And I was also calm at the same time. So that's something that I believe is a byproduct of years of contemplative practice, specifically in my case, meditation. So there's this sense that I want to say to people, prepare now, not from a perspective of fear and anxiety, but prepare by living fully. Live realizing that each moment is precious, and we know that because this moment will never be again. I think that became more clear to me than ever. You know, we know those things on a certain level, but when suddenly you're faced with the reality that you came very close to death, your perspective of life itself changes. And the practices that were meaningful to me for many years became more so. Certainly my ability to be calm in a stressful situation was really tested. My confidence and belief in the human body, which I think is absolutely miraculous, was tested, but the human body, in my case, responded, and although seriously injured, was able to come back. I couldn't walk for a while, but I can now, absolutely, I'd say just about as well as I did before. Use of my hands was very questionable because they were seriously burned, but I just, you know, finished writing a book with my hands. So prepare now is essentially the message.
You were burned over 33% of your body. Your wife, of course, was injured as well. Not as severe as your injuries. And actually, she contributes to this book, recalling things that you are unable to recall because of the injuries that you suffered. But the first thing for you was to ensure your wife's escape. How clearly can you remember that moment?
Well, that I remember very clearly. There's only one blank spot in my memory, and psychotherapists call that the action of the benevolent brain, and that's the time that I was actually in the fire. After I pushed my wife out through the emergency door, which was ablaze, but we knew that was our only way out, my intention was to follow right after her, but my foot caught on something, and I don't know what, because the smoke was so thick and black and dense that I couldn't see. So at that point, I remember that that happened and that I was stuck, but then comes a blank spot in my memory. Could be 30 or 40 seconds, hard to know. The next thing I knew was that I had just landed on the ground. So according to my wife's account, she looked up at the door. The emergency door kept yelling to me. Finally, I appeared there and I jumped out. And that's when my memory comes back again. I was helped at that point because I couldn't walk. First by two young teenagers who tried to help, but I was just a lot bigger than they are, and they couldn't really help me very much. So two men stepped in. They helped me get away from the plane before it exploded. But all the rest, my memory is there. I can't necessarily tell you what happened in the hospital in Bangkok, or was that in the hospital in Singapore, or was it in the hospital back here in New York City? But I do remember the specifics. I remember going through ICU psychosis and just having a grand time singing away and proclaiming monologues dating back to my days on Broadway. It's all there. I just can't tell you exactly when and where it happened.
Do you remember being transferred from the plane crash site to the first burn unit?
It's kind of. It's vague. I was in really bad shape at that time, undoubtedly in shock and very hazy. And then also my memory may be fooled a bit, because in order to write this book, I actually had to interview my wife, and we did that very slowly because obviously that was a very traumatic time for her, essentially just trying to keep me alive while dealing with her own physical pain. So yes, vague memory, again, getting to Singapore, clearer memories in Singapore, dealing with this extraordinary doctor, B.K. Tan, who actually was the first person who said to me he thought I could survive and actually could have use of my hands again. Nobody had ever said that. And then I was heavily medicated in order to make the 30-hour medevac flight from Singapore to New York. Vague memory of landing in New York. There was a tremendous amount of fuss. Lots of people in white coats running around, pulling me from the small plane to the hospital. In fact, I do remember at one point asking them to just do one thing at a time with me, because it was getting overwhelming to have so many people pushing and pulling and all trying to help, of course, but it was difficult to handle all of that at once.
You were told, and your wife was told, that you probably would not live, that you would not make it.
She was told. I overheard that once. In fact, what I heard was this doctor say to her, oh, this man can't possibly live. And I heard her say to him, you don't know this man. And later on, when I thought about that, months later, I thought the truth was he didn't know that woman. She was not about to let me die on her watch, or at least not without putting up a really good fight. I never at any point actually knew that doctors thought I was going to die. And it was literally almost 2 years later, when I was filming a piece for CBS Sunday Morning, they asked if I had any pictures of me right after the accident. I knew there were some pictures, but I had never seen them. So I obtained those pictures, and when I looked at myself right after the accident, then I knew why the doctors thought that I wouldn't live. The person in those pictures was really seriously injured. And I say it that way because, not with any sense of denial that that was me, but there's almost a certain separation. That person was so injured and clearly looked as if he was going to die. When I first looked at those pictures, I then turned and looked in the mirror. And I said, wow, that's as if that was not me. Here I am alive, barely on my face. There's a little two-tone area next to my right eye where the flames got really close. The little nick out of my left ear. But, you know, they thought I was going to lose that whole ear. So in so many instances, what looked like to the doctors would happen somehow didn't happen. Why that is, truthfully, I don't know. You know, we all have certain beliefs about how these things happen. For me, bottom line, I'm considering myself incredibly fortunate. I believe that my practices through the years leading to this time were instrumental, but I can't actually tell you exactly why. My whole reason for writing this book was to speak about what I think contributed, and the fact that while very few people will ever go through a plane crash, and even fewer will survive it, we all are going through crashes all the time. But we call the crash a divorce. We call the crash an illness or a sprained ankle or financial loss or difficulties in the workplace. We go through that all the time. And what I felt that I could offer in writing a book like this would be insights into how I got through a very difficult situation.
Alan Locos is our guest this morning. His new book is Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. You spoke a moment ago of having trust in the practices that you had adopted early in your life. A Buddhist, you had spent many, many years cultivating these meditative practices. And you mentioned earlier that some of those were put to a test, were challenged by the situation. Were you ever surprised that you were able, looking back on it and in writing this book, of course there is survival, but also through the recovery and through the incident itself, that you were able to bring everything, that it wasn't just something that you wanted to believe in, it's something that was actually a part of you?
Probably the biggest surprise of all came about maybe a year or a year and a half later, when I realized that if there was such a thing as a magic pill or some sort of magician that could cause the clock to be turned back and I wouldn't go through that experience, I think at that point I realized that I wouldn't take that pill. I wouldn't go back. Now, obviously, if I knew before getting on that plane what was going to happen, I would not have got on the plane. But now, having had the experience, there's so much that has come to me in the way of growth and insight and opportunity to be of benefit to people in ways that I couldn't before or that were limited before. It's not something that I would want to give back. And I know that's odd because I have to now, there's still some pain in my hands. My hands don't look the way they did. By the way, just as a tangent, I don't have fingerprints anymore. So, you know, I have a whole opportunity for a new career in front of me, but I'll probably pass on that because things are going well right now.
Yeah.
But I think it probably sounds odd when people hear me say that I wouldn't go back. I'd have to give up too much that I've gained through this experience. As I said, I know it sounds strange, but I think that's where I am at this point.
The fact that you are able to tell this story now, because one of the things that I found just remarkable in reading the book is that this happened in 2012. I mean, this was just over 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
This still seems, at least it would to me, to be remarkably fresh in your mind.
Yes. My thought when I was being asked so often after the accident, first by just close friends who were visiting and then later people at the meditation community where I teach, how did I survive? How did this happen? All of those sort of questions that come naturally. I began to realize that I would write a book, but I would wait until I was really feeling better because it was very difficult at that time. This all sounds great now, but I assure you that the whole experience was horrendous. But a friend said, don't wait until you feel better. What people need to hear is what you're going through right now, because this is what everybody goes through, not a plane crash, but the difficulties of life. You know, the joys and the beauty and the wonder of life are all woven into a fabric that also includes the difficulties and the pains and the sorrows and the suffering. It's just the nature of existence in human form, and they can just come quickly. One moment, it's just so wonderful playing with your child or your grandchild or getting wonderful news, and the next moment that turns around. The Buddhists talk about the vicissitudes of life, how gain turns to loss, how fame turns to ignominy. It is the nature of life, and when we see that, then we don't suffer so much with it. We realize we're not doing something wrong. We're not being punished for something. People ask, didn't I ever ask myself, why me? Why did this happen to me? And the answer to that question is no. I never entertained that question Because the only answer to why me would be, why not me? I have wonderful things happen in my life, but difficult things happen as well. This just happened to be my time for something difficult. Fortunately, I was able to get through it. And I would say in many ways, my life is probably better now, and my life was very good before.
You write quite beautifully in the book about patience. And I was struck by what you wrote, because you say that so many of us think of it as a commodity. But it is something that you have to look at differently. And ultimately, it was with you throughout all of this, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I think that our language kind of gets in the way and influences the way we think. We say, I've run out of patience.
Right.
As if there is this thing that we have and I've used it up now, so I have no more patience.
It's fine.
Patience is not a thing. Patience and impatience are simply feelings. Feelings that arise. If we have the feeling of impatience, then we say, I've run out of patience. But again, impatience is just a feeling. Sometimes we even characterize ourselves by these feelings and say, I'm not a patient person. Well, that's really too simplistic, because we're very complex beings. In one situation, we may be impatient, while in another situation, while everybody else is carrying on, we're very patient. So we can learn to notice feelings as they begin to arise. You can be in a conversation, a perfectly easeful conversation, and someone says something, and it just gently touches a button inside, and you can feel the impatience arise. Why did she say that? Oh, I'm going to have to correct that, and I'm going to have to correct it really firmly. And we take off and we write our stories. But if we realize just in this moment, I was just impatient with that, maybe I could pause for a moment and then address that in a way that is a bit more compassionate and a bit more wise and with a sense of equanimity. And then there's more peace in our lives. So that kind of practice we refer to as seeing the ways in which we cause ourselves suffering and stress and unhappiness, and learning how to alleviate those ways.
Does calm help you be in control and to command yourself and a situation?
Well, yes, as long as we realize that we have much less control throughout life than we might like to believe.
But, I apologize, I just want to...
Sure.
So, because, but in your, like, in that moment when the plane crashes, of course, you don't have control of that situation, but then you have control of your situation.
Right. The big event happens, the plane crashes. Now, what I do in that circumstance is determined by what goes on in my mind. And if my mind is my ally rather than the mind that most of us are used to, the mind that we call a monkey mind that's just busy all the time, we have busy lives. And we continue to have busy lives. Sometimes a person retires and they can't believe how busy they are, planning the next golf date, planning lunch, planning who they're going to see a film with. We are convinced that we have to be busy. And in that busyness, we don't seem to have any control. The control is within ourselves, within our minds, and that's what we can control. What we can't control as much would be the results. We can make a plan. Say we do make a plan for lunch with a friend. We can't control that friend comes on time or maybe even forgets. And we get really annoyed. How can we forget? I was really looking forward to this lunch. And we take off on a story and we don't want to ever speak to that person again. And the person simply forgot. And we lose sight of the fact that one time we forgot. We're humans. We while we are incredible and in many ways perfect beings, we also all need a little bit of work to deal with our imperfections. And that's all the workings of the mind. Meditation practice is really about working with the mind so that we can see the ways in which we cause ourselves difficulties and then see how we can begin to reduce them and ultimately even end them.
How was meditation altered for you because of the shock you were going through, as you talked about, of where your memory lapses, and also due to the medication and so forth that was helping make you better? Was meditation always a part of that, or is it something that you had to reacquaint yourself with as you progressed in your treatment?
Well, a most insightful question. Meditation is very significant in my life and in many ways the bedrock for me. But when I came home, there was no meditating really in a formal way in the hospital because, right, as you suggested, there was medication, there was so much going on, there was physical pain. It would have been very difficult. But I assumed that as soon as I got home, I could get back to my practice. And it was exactly the opposite. It was very upsetting to me that what I count on a lot is that practice, and I couldn't do it. I actually called my teacher of many, many years, and she said immediately, no, you can't practice right now. You're just not capable of doing it. Nobody would be. But gradually, I think I remember just starting with a minute at a time, just seeing if I could stay focused on one breath, the entire breath, all the way in and then all the way out. And then gradually that became 3 breaths. And then I was able to do 5 minutes. It took some time and it took determination. But, you know, I also have a history, and I was certainly motivated by my experience of the benefits that I had experienced through the years. But it was very difficult to come back, exactly for the reasons that you said, the enormous disruption to my body and the entire experience, but ultimately was able to come back. I added Tai Chi into my life, which I had never done before, which is a meditative as well as a physical practice. Very, very useful. And fortunately for me, I also love doing it.
As I mentioned before, the subtitle of the book is Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. We have focused much of our talk on patience and determination. Talk a little bit about the compassion, because I assume you're talking about the compassion that your wife had for you and also your own compassion.
Yes, exactly. You know, we don't tend to be very good at things like self-compassion and loving oneself. You know, I think it's kind of unfortunate that so many of us were raised with the belief that we're not worthy beings. The perspective that comes to us from the wisdom traditions of the East is exactly the opposite. There is an expression that says if you search the entire universe to find a being more worthy of your love and tenderness than you are yourself, you could never find such a person, suggesting that you are also fully worthy of your love and of your compassion. I needed to have compassion for myself. I was going through the worst hell that I had ever known. Deep, dark depression, which I think I said before, really started when I got home, which was surprising. Right. The compassion for my wife and the love for my wife, we've been very fortunate. We've always had a wonderful relationship, very close and loving. Without her, I never would have made it. I mean, she really got me back home, got me the medical care that was necessary to save my life. Now, the opportunity for me to support her as she deals with the really horrific trauma that she has to deal with, plus the physical pain that she's dealing with. She put all of that aside for months just to keep me alive. So now we really have to turn our attention to her as well. compassion is the ability to relate to the suffering of another. One way of defining that is we actually can feel the quivering of the heart in relation to the pain and suffering of another. And then we respond to that, if it's possible to do so, to help in any way that we can.
The name of the book is Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. The book is published by Tarcher Penguin. Alan Locos, thank you so much for sharing your story with us this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. So happy to be with you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. Alan Locos is the author. The book is published by Penguin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.